Danny Dawley's been a friend of also for years. He won our transmission prize for communication of ideas because he has a phenomenal way of getting a huge amount of data, about social geography data, into graphs which are going to blow your mind. And today's going to be no exception as he presents to us Pandemic. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Danny Dawley.
Thank you, and thank you for putting up with me wanting to talk about a pandemic that you've come here to try and get away from. I'm a social scientist, so what I do is look at current trends and things that are happening. So we couldn't not look at the pandemic. I'll tell you the answer very quickly to this question. The answer is it isn't the worst pandemic in living memory. Why do we have that title? I think it was Boris Johnson said it was, but numerous people have said you're living through the worst pandemic in living memory, and I'll show you a bit later why that isn't the case. But it's bad. In case you were getting upset that I was going to downplay it, it's certainly very bad, and I can show you ways in which it's possible to say it's in the top three of the last 100 years, say. I'll show you that a bit later. I also should give you a warning before we begin. I'm not a medic. I don't look at viral diseases. I have published a couple of dozen papers in journals with the title Epidemiology, but I haven't looked at this kind of disease ever. I have published an atlas called the Grim Reaper's Roadmap. It wasn't supposed to be called the Grim Reaper's Roadmap. That was the working title. The publisher didn't change it. Looking at the 100 most likely ways to die in Britain. So I've got some idea of exciting stuff if you ever get bored. Let's go to the first slide. I'm going to talk to you about cholera, because I think the nearest equivalent in some ways to COVID-19 is cholera, particularly in terms of how frightened people are, how little we knew, how much we learn, how we don't understand we're learning. So we think we know loads now, but we're going to know so much more in 6 months' time. The most famous outbreak of cholera in English history is 1854. There were earlier outbreaks, but cholera didn't exist in the 1700s or 1600s. And we didn't know what caused it. My favourite example of a theory of what caused it was Henry Acland's theory, and I always get this wrong. I think I've got it right here. It's either cholera comes to a town when you have thunder in a thunderstorm, but you can see no lightning, or it's when you get lightning but you can't hear any thunder. Anyway, I won't look around to try and get it right, but it's one or the other. And what Henry Acland did is pay, I think it was students, he paid them to sit up in the top of a tower, endlessly, waiting for a thunderstorm, so they could then see whether the thunder came without lightning or lightning without thunder. This is long before germ theory. This is when people thought that cholera came from a thing called miasma. You can smell it, it's in the air, which kind of made sense, because we now know it's cholera from infected water. But we didn't know at the time. Let's go forward from Oxford to... If you type human geography into Wikipedia, the first thing you'll see is this map. And it's a really famous map. It's John Snow's map of the 1854 outbreak of cholera in London. And it's there because it's supposed to show the greatest use of a map. John Snow was the anaesthetist of the Queen. And in theory, John Snow plotted all the cases of people dying of cholera and noticed there was a cluster around Broad Street in Soho and went and took the handle off the pump and stopped the epidemic. That's the story. Now, there are several reasons why we know this isn't true. But John Snow was a very good man. What he did was useful, but it wasn't true. The first reason we know it's not true is that the map has the pump at its centre. Now, you don't discover the centre of a cholera epidemic just happens to be in the middle of your map. Right? They'd already worked out where the centre of the epidemic was before they drew the map, then drew the map and then went, look, there it is. But the second reason, we know that this story isn't actually the heroic story of ending an infectious disease, is that the number of deaths in Soho from cholera were already falling long before he took the handle off the pump. Now you might be wondering, what's this got to do with COVID-19? And the relationship is with lockdown. Is to what extent was lockdown actually the thing which caused the disease to reduce or not? We don't yet know. There are thousands and thousands of papers. Most of them published without refereeing, which will be refereed, some of them, but the majority won't be because they can't physically fit in the journals. And we will find out later. What I'm going to take you through now is a series of graphs that I drew as this thing was happening. So I'm going to try and give you an idea of thinking at the time from the beginning of it onwards. That text there, by the way, if any of you can read it, is a made-up interview with Jon Snow. And you can tell it's made up because the language isn't 19th century English. But it's somebody claiming that what Jon Snow did by removing the handle from the pump is prevent the second wave of cholera that would have come if we hadn't done it. And of course that's reminiscent of our times. Second waves are fascinating in these things. The last big infectious disease that we had of this kind, sharp up, relatively sharp down, was influenza in 1968. I was around. You were, my cousin's here. You were just born at the end of the epidemic in 1968, I think. I can't remember, of course, I was a baby. But what I do know is that my father, who's never ill, was in bed for a week, unable physically to get out of bed. I won't do a poll and ask if anybody can remember the influenza epidemic of 1968. Killed about the same number of people in America as have died of COVID so far. I think killed over 1 million worldwide. The second wave of the 1968 influenza epidemic, this is the most recent epidemic of that kind. The second wave came in 1970, 2 years later. The third wave came in 1972. So this is hopefully useful to you to know about second and third waves. They don't happen immediately, right? They're not instant. I don't think we're in any second wave anywhere yet. And we don't yet know, we really don't know what's going to happen, I think. Some people do think they know, but I don't think we do know. Last picture about cholera, by the way. And then the way this does matter, the little map at the top is a map drawn in 1890 of poverty in London. Soho, which is just off that map, was particularly poor. The reason why there was a concentration of people dying of cholera in Soho had more to do with the fact that you couldn't get out of Soho because you didn't have enough money to leave London, because you had to work, because you had jobs that you couldn't do from home, if you like. This is 1854, than to do with that particular pump. The rich fled. The rich left. And in some ways it's slightly reminiscent with what happened in March and April, where I got phone calls from well-off journalists, and I said, where are you? And they said, Cornwall. And I said, what are you doing in Cornwall? And I said, oh, we're in our cottage. And it's amazing to find out how many people had places to bolt. But that happened with cholera. Let's go forward. I've only published one paper with some Chinese colleagues that's been refereed on cholera, on COVID. And that was looking at the spread in China, which had more to do with entrepreneurs and business travel than anything else, which shows you how China has changed. And I wrote three articles for something called The Conversation, and this is from the first one of them. And in a way, it's illustrative of how little I knew and who I mixed with. What that bar chart, I don't expect you to be able to read it, it's just a useful prop to me, shows, is how many people were dying in the first 13 weeks of each year. The point I was trying to make is it was actually quite low, the number of people who were dying at the start of this year. It had been low in 2019, but it had been higher earlier. We've had to have at least 10,000 COVID-19 deaths to get ourselves back up to where we have been in 2018, 2015. And those years were particularly bad, I think, because of austerity and cuts. I think it's 2015 where we shut the hospitals. Was it for 2 or 3 months? For all but emergency surgery? You probably have forgotten that. That was no pandemic. That was just lack of funding that we did that for. So why was I sticking this up? Because the people I work with who do look at infectious disease had most recently dealt with swine flu, MERS and SARS. And in the cases of all those diseases, Imperial College had produced an incredible projection and it had been wrong. So what did we smugly think was going to go on? At the beginning of this in February and very early March, people like me thought, oh, this will be small, because they tend to be small. We were very, very wrong. I'm admitting that to you now. But you could see why. Foot and mouth was the other one that they predicted. So you have a situation in which you've got a new disease, but your last 4 or 5 cases of a new disease have not resulted in something that has been very, very big at all. That map down there, by the way, is a world map shaped by the number of cases of COVID, must forget about cholera now, COVID-19 early on. And you can see China's slightly smaller than Europe, and the Americas are tiny. That was the kind of beginning of it. And I drew some of these weird diagrams with my friend Kirsty. They kind of made sense at the beginning of drawing them. They get a bit more complicated later. I didn't like the diagrams the Financial Times drew, which have curves that just go up and then go flat and give you very little information of the cumulative number of cases. What this shows, and these are different countries, the blue at the top is the United States, is the number of people dying per day, and this is by April the 7th, and whether that's increasing or decreasing. And you can see suddenly we're at 800, 1,000 dying a day. It was incredibly fast. We tend, I don't know, it may just be me, but we tend to forget how things felt at the time. On the 23rd of March, I was in London, and I can remember walking along pavements and people avoiding everybody. Social distancing began on the 23rd of March. I was meeting my friend Martin McKee, who's a member of Alternative Sage now. And me and Martin, both old men, Martin older than me, were sitting in a very small room chatting about COVID-19. March 23rd turned out to be the date of the highest number of infections. 2 weeks later, we had the highest number of deaths. It was that quick, that fast, how it went up from almost nothing. So appearing to spiral out of control, but different patterns in different countries. And it really was a time of no idea. And what I'm partly trying to do, it's a little bit of an excuse for Dominic Cummings. Just a little bit. Now, I didn't have the kind of information that Dominic Cummings had, because Dominic Cummings actually saw the numbers that were secret at the time. He saw them early. But Dominic Cummings went from thinking, this will be nothing, the advisors are saying it'll be like those other infectious diseases that go through, to shit, this thing is tripling every 4 days. We've got no idea what's going to happen. It might not stop at killing 800 or 1,000 people a day. It's all over Westminster. London could fall apart. And if I was Dominic Cummings, I'd be thinking, and I'm the only person with a couple of other dozen people who know this. And the next thing I would have done, and so I'm not, don't expect you to be impressed by me, but I would have done this. I'd have got in a car and I'd have driven 250 miles north out of London. Right? That's the only reason to drive 250 miles north out of London is if you see those very early projections and you think there will be people dying in the streets in London if this thing continues. It's going to be out of control. It's going to be horrible. You want to be as far away from London as you can be. That's, I'm just saying, if it would be me, that's how I would have behaved. If I didn't think that and I lived in London, I'd have gone to stay with my sister in London, got some other help. The only thing that would have made sense for getting out of London that far is if you're really worried about what was going to happen in London. And that was, people like me kind of get the data a week, 2 weeks after Dominic, and that's what I saw. But of course we were not quite so scared, because also you saw what was happening at the time, you got rumours, you knew from your friends who worked in the hospitals what was happening. It wasn't as bad as the projections. That's the inset in that graph for anybody who's nerdy about China and Germany. China, the record is incredible. By the way, we shouldn't call it the China virus for obvious reasons. If you are going to call it the China virus, you have to call the Spanish flu the American virus, because it almost certainly started on a pig farm in the USA way back in 1917. You've got to ask, how did the young man get that near the pig? But anyway, I was always thinking when Donald Trump once called it the China virus, there's an embarrassing story that has to be told. Anyway, sorry, to go back to this. Even if the real rate was 100 times higher in China, fewer people have died than the US. And the real rate isn't 100 times higher. Incredible what social distancing, fear, some sense of order can be, an idea that you actually do what you're told. But Germany not dissimilar originally. Germany not dissimilar at all. Germany quite like Sweden. If you want, we'll have a chance for questions. So if you want to have a go at me, there'll be plenty of options for that. But different than the other countries zooming up. We don't really know how it got here. We say we do. People who look at the DNA of it say, oh, we can tell it came to Italy first and then to Spain, and it came from Italy and Spain and a bit from France and the UK. But then you get another paper looking at the DNA that tells a different story, and another paper looking at the DNA that tells a different story. So we don't know, and we're learning. What we do now know is it was everywhere in this country by February. It was all over by February. Absolutely spread around. It wasn't spread around everywhere in other countries. It wasn't in the south of Italy. It wasn't in more rural areas of France. Outside of Madrid, in Spain, there are areas of very, very low. But England, Wales, and to an extent Scotland, it was all over. And we don't yet know the reasons. I can't help, quietly between you and me, if you don't say it, I can't help thinking our university system might not have an effect. In other countries, you tend to go to the local university. In Britain, we have a system of making people move right across the country at the start of term and the end of terms, which is a brilliant way of transmitting a disease across the whole country. And a lot of international students. But anyway, I'll go off that. There's loads and loads of data. Most of it's pretty untrustworthy. The best data we have is about people dying. The best data on that is from ONS, and it's when a doctor has mentioned COVID on a death certificate, and even then it's not that reliable. Early on, doctors were very reticent to mention on the death certificate, because all hell would break loose at the beginning if you said you thought somebody had died of COVID and you had a test. And there were some instructions implying they shouldn't mention it. Later on, I think the pressure on doctors is to, if there's any chance, mention it. It's a possibility. You don't want to upset the family by not mentioning it. And later on, and certainly more recently, quite a few people who've died with mention of COVID on their death certificate, it probably hasn't been the main reason why they've died. I don't look at cases at all, because the data on cases is so awful, except for the new ONS survey which I don't know if any of you are in. My mum and dad are in it. And what they do in the ONS survey is they send you a swab, and you've got to test negative first. And then every week they test you, and that's the only way of actually seeing if the cases go up or not. And we're only ramping that up in October to a big enough sample. Anyway, there's the beginning of it. Let's zoom forward. This is a geographical distribution. There are 7,201 small areas in England and Wales of the same population. By April the 17th, only 1,200 of those 7,201 areas had not had a death. By April 17th, just 10 days after the peak. Just 5 weeks after I was sitting in somebody's office in London saying, we don't think this will be enormous, it's, you know, enough of a worry, but it might not alter the life expectancy figure for this year. Right? Deaths in all but 1,200 areas. And a few weeks later, that most of those 1,200 areas had a death from COVID. That's why we know it was all over the place in February. This is what happens to that swirly graph. At that point, the Financial Times publishes an article about this being the worst graph ever drawn of COVID. So it did go viral, but it is too complicated to kind of understand. And it begins to come down. How many people die who get it? We still don't really know. Partly because we're in a position of learning. It's quite interesting. More scientists have done more work on COVID-19, because there are more scientists alive now and employed, than any other disease ever in a short amount of time. But we still really don't know the answer. My guesses are that of every 1,000 people who get it, if they get it across an average age distribution, for every 1,000 people who get it, about 100 will show symptoms and be pretty poorly, 1 in 10, and 1 will die. This data is very disputed. This is really early on. This was published in April 27th. It's the case fatality rates for different countries. And the reason that this is done, and was done with those other diseases I mentioned at the beginning, is that the country with the lowest rate tends to be the one that ends up being true. And in this case, it was Singapore, and it was 1 in 1,000 people who have it die of an average age range. If 1,020-year-olds have it, you almost certainly won't get a death. Or 10,000, or even 100,000 20-year-olds. If 1,000 people in care homes get it, you get a lot of deaths, because age is by far the biggest predictor. Having COVID-19, on average, for you, is like being 15 years older. So for me, I'm 52, it'll be like being 67 years old for those years. Not too much to worry about, but still actually a bigger risk than other things. If you're 90, it's like being 105, and you don't want to be 105 for a few weeks. We've lost 1% of 90-year-olds so far, maybe 1.5%. And here's it coming down, and it came down a lot more slowly than it went up. And this isn't like flu. Flu tends to come down as fast as it goes up. Why does this come down more slowly? A little bit because of geographical spread, but also because it's new. It's a new disease. We don't have people with that much immunity to it. Although we do have 4 coronaviruses already in circulation. This is the 5th one. Those are the graphs for each region. And you can see they look pretty similar. Peaks in London a week before the other regions, and that's part of the reason why the spread is elongated, because it's spread out across the country. I'm going to zoom on a bit. And here's it beginning to fall. Here's the tumbling down. This graph was done by the end of May. The UK is, I think, the green one down there. Now, you could still say at the 31st of May, there were more people dying in the UK than the whole of Europe put together. And it was true. And you could say our government was particularly bad, and that would be true. But it was almost beginning to be over in terms of the peak of the pandemic, the worst time. In contrast, the USA then went up again to 1,000 deaths a day, now down again in higher cases. Going forward, to show you how, to give you a sort of sense of time of the move in this. This was at the point when just over 50,000 people had died. And these are the 50,000 where a medic had written with COVID on the death certificate. Almost exactly half of those are symmetrical, the other half drawn in red are not. And increasingly over time, the proportion of people who died with COVID who are not dying primarily because of it rises. This has nothing to do, by the way, with the Public Health England measure and the daily count measure. That was completely different and less reliable. The one that came from hospitals, the one that always went down at weekends. This is actually how many people actually died on that day. And look at the smoothness of the thing. It doesn't show reactions necessarily to particular events. Worst pandemic in living memory? The answer is no. I've already talked to you about 1968, which was similar. I could talk about 1957 flu, which was similar. But the best example, which is within some people's living memory, is 1951. And in 1951, in the peak weeks, in urban areas, we were getting over 10,000 deaths a week from flu. And in the urban areas of Britain, for a few weeks, just 2 or 3 weeks, we're getting 9,000 from COVID-19. So the 1951 flu pandemic was worse. And wait for it, there are fewer people. And they're younger. Right? So, you know, it shouldn't matter that much, but we shouldn't think of this thing as being the most dramatic epidemic since 1918. There are other epidemics as well, which are slower, AIDS, which we forget, but because it's a slow epidemic, it's different. The other thing well worth saying, and it's interesting to compare it with AIDS and the reaction to this, COVID-19 was almost the opposite politically to AIDS. AIDS was a disease that early on was thought to mainly affect men who were gay, and many politicians and people didn't worry about it because they were not men, or if they were men that were gay at that time, they were often pretending they weren't gay. COVID's the opposite. COVID was a disease that affected business people. It affected tourists who were rich enough to go skiing. It affected politicians. And that's similar to cholera. Why is it similar to cholera? Because cholera hit the Russian court, I think in 1833. And because it hit the Russian court, the rich were scared across Europe of cholera. Really scared. It was just chance it hit the Russian court. But the rich being scared of cholera meant that after 1854 and that outbreak in London, they put in even better sewer systems. And in a sense, the rich being scared of COVID is useful. That. If COVID had only affected poor people, if COVID didn't affect a widespread cross-section of the population, our attitude to it may have been very, very different to what it was. These graphs are for Liverpool in 1951. I've shown you too many graphs, so I won't bore you, but just to say, 500 deaths in a peak week as opposed to, I think, 150 in Liverpool now. So people have lived through worse things. If you're a bit annoyed at me saying it doesn't look at the worst of living memory, there's enough way of counting it. You can look at the increase in deaths per year. And if you do that, COVID-19 comes out as the fifth biggest event, I think, in the last 160 years. Because we have had a big increase in deaths. Because the tail's gone on for a long time. Because it's not sharp up and down like flu. So in terms of the increase of deaths, more people have died from COVID. Except that 1940 was the worst year. And 1940 is just in living memory for some people. Almost at the end now. So please do think of some questions. I'm hoping Helen's going to be around. Yeah, confident. Okay. life expectancy. This graph is worth looking at. If you go look at one last graph. This is life expectancy for men and women. For most of the last century, it goes up like that. Incredible rises in life expectancy. Can be a quarter of a year in good years. At the beginning of the last century, it's because infant mortality is going down, babies are surviving. Later on, it's old age mortality getting better. And when you see life expectancy stops rising after 2011, 2012, plateaus, actually falls after 2014. What's COVID-19 done to life expectancy? It's reduced it by almost exactly a year for men and women in the year to the end of June this year. That's big, using a year of life expectancy. But if you were to draw that diagonal trend forward, you'd see that austerity cuts, whatever else it was, has actually reduced our life expectancy by more than COVID-19, by a couple of years that we should have got. If you want to argue, almost there. Yeah. If you want to argue about whether more cases of people who die with COVID-19 are not primarily because of COVID, the kind of evidence is this. This is the ratio of men by age to women dying with COVID-19. At the beginning, twice as many men were dying than women, say of age 75. That goes down as the proportion of people who are dying but have had COVID-19 increases. And really sad things going on now. The whole thing's sad, of course. So I apologise about sounding callous. People who count deaths and measure deaths, you can't kind of help but not sound callous. The saddest thing going on most recently, we get the statistics every week on Tuesday about 10 o'clock. 300 more people died last week than the 5-year average. 300 more. The number who died of COVID might be 80, might be 70. So what's killing most of those people who've died more than average? We know it's not COVID now. It's things like being stuck in a care home where nobody's come to see you, where the workers are exhausted. It's things like, of course, the cancer diagnoses that weren't made, but not many of them yet. It's the beginnings of a few more suicides that begin to happen, but mainly, it is the very elderly dying of things that aren't COVID at a higher rate now, because things have fallen apart, because our hospitals are not back to normal. And that's the thing that annoys me the most. If you remember, I showed you the picture of when Jon Snow took the handle off the pump, and that was Broad Street in Soho. Soho's in the borough of Westminster. Neil Ferguson, if you remember, said that there was a lot of COVID in Westminster. These are the deaths from COVID in Westminster. And I've drawn a little line there for when the lockdown, or 2 weeks, I think, before the lockdown happened. The line really should move because we know people die later with COVID now. And essentially what I'm wanting to suggest is the lockdown was not the key event in turning the curve. The key event was social distancing, fear that began earlier. Thankfully, the government could have saved a lot of people, not necessarily by doing a lockdown a week earlier, but by dealing with the care homes completely differently. That's where they could have made the biggest intervention. Why didn't they do a lockdown earlier? And they said why they didn't, and they said at the time, and it's quite remarkable, they were worried that people would not abide by the instruction. If you remember them saying, they didn't want to do a lockdown earlier because they thought, and they said, if we do it too early, people might do it for a little bit, but then they'll get bored and they won't do it anymore, so we need to do it later. Now that turns out to be completely wrong. In fact, we almost have the opposite situation. People in some senses may be too fearful. We're getting more people dying now because of greater fear. But why did the government think, and these people in London think, that people wouldn't obey a lockdown? And the reason we now know, it's fairly obvious, is that they thought that other people in Britain were like them, and they wouldn't obey a lockdown. Right? And it's not their fault. We all think that everybody else is like us. But that's why we didn't get it slightly earlier. But even if we got it earlier, I don't think it would have made a huge amount of difference. The very, very, very latest data for you, the black lines are Wales, the red curve is England. I've drawn it on a log scale. This is the best quality data we've got. And the point of putting it up to you is to say, it's smooth. Look how incredibly smooth it is. This isn't something that's gone up and down when they allowed travel, did this or did that. This is a disease very like past diseases, where we intervened less. The social distancing, everything you're doing here is very good. It is absolutely sensible to do. But we haven't had a series of things that had an effect. We haven't had what the CDC report, which was produced at the very beginning, was pulled out at the beginning, for what to do in the event of a 1918 type flu said. If you remember, it's going to flatten the curve, and then we get a series of little peaks like this. That's what we got. Completely different to that. And that's my last slide with that curve without a log scale. Now what we don't know, I'm going to leave you on what we don't know before Helen takes questions. What we don't know is this. Are we at the summer low? That a coronavirus always has a summer low in August, and it will come up again significantly. Or could it actually be as good as this? Now, this still does mean 10 people dying a day. That is one of the rarest forms of death in England when you have 10 people dying a day. It means a lot more people being seriously ill and suffering for a long time, if not the rest of their lives. But that would be very, very good. And we don't yet know whether that is the weather being outdoors or not. We do know that all the other four coronaviruses became pretty weak in their effect on us. There were lots of guesses that the most recent one, the fourth coronavirus, might have emerged in 1889. Was mistaken for flu, and if it's true, that would be really good news, because we had one bad, what we thought was a flu year, the Russian flu, I think, of 1889, and then no second or third wave, with no vaccine, no intervention, no understanding of germs. That's the best you can hope for. The worst is what we worry about, and partly because we worry about it, that's good also, because we will control it. I am not that worried about the disease. I am more and more increasingly worried about the mental health and physical health of the population as a fallout of dealing with disease. I'm worried about thousands of university students sitting in rooms this autumn, actually obeying the instructions not to socialise, and only having contact by Zoom. It's bad enough sometimes being a student, whereas if you are forced not to engage, that could be worse. Thank you for letting me talk at you for 40 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, Danny Dorling. I just want to say thank you so much, Danny. It was really your data that helped us as the cooperative who run the festival to feel confident enough to do it. You know, in amongst everything else that we had to do, it was really your data that helped us have, you know, the confidence to put it on. So thank you so much, and I'm so glad you're here for us. Thank you. You make us feel all better with your lovely graphs. Questions are tough. The way we're going to do it, we do have a QR code set up and everything, but it's just really tricky in the field at the moment. Has anyone got a question? If you can ask me, Michael, and then I will... Because we can't share mics, you see. for Michael. Why did the government put so much trust in Neil Ferguson?
Okay. By the way, I should say it's. I think this is the largest legal gathering of this kind, by the way, going on this summer, which is quite incredible. And of course, almost infinitely safer than the illegal ones. Why did they put the trust in Neil? Partly because he came up with his model results almost exactly the time when they suddenly realised that this was out of control. So they had something, at least they had something. The estimate of 510,000 dying was ridiculous. That was the dog ate my model mistakes in the old code kind of stuff. So we were never, from this particular virus, going to get 510,000 people dying. But it was something. He gave them something at a time. And also, in a little world of epidemiology that I'm on the edge of, they didn't know the stories of Imperial and the repeated crying wolf and always saying, this thing is going to kill a lot of people. All the story of Neil's old boss, let me try not to libel him or myself, but was sponsored by the firm that produced Tamiflu and produced a model that resulted in £60 million worth of it being purchased by the government. Okay, so that skepticism side of Imperial wasn't there. I should be fair as well to Imperial. There's a long-running feud between the University of Oxford and Imperial on modelling these things. And kind of Imperial got it right this time. Question at the back.
Question from Harold here. It's been coming from also from the beginning. Thank you, Harold. And he says, which is your field, as Harold points out, what will be the effect on housing of fewer people going into care homes?
Oh, what will the effect on housing? Everybody's been fascinated by it. Well, question about what happened in general on housing. You can still get into care homes. The care homes are desperate for people to come in, otherwise they'll go bust. And of course, younger relatives are fairly desperate to get their older relatives into the care homes. So they're still going in. Putting it very bluntly, at least 25,000 of the people who've died were very elderly, living on their own in a house which is now vacant and on the market. So if you're wondering why The Guardian talked about a huge increase in transactions on the market, it's partly the sale of housing of people who've died of COVID. We're also economically waiting to see the effects of all of this on the housing market. And that matters for all kinds of separate reasons. The government are doing all they can to keep housing prices high, where they should be falling. I won't bore you more than that, but if house prices were to fall, which is what happens when young adults decide they can work from home here rather than rent a flat in London because the office in London is closed, when house prices fall, all kinds of things change. At the moment, they're being deliberately and artificially held up for a time. I won't go further into. At least care homes now have scrutiny of a greater degree than they had before. But the sad thing is, the scrutiny before was relatives going in. We got into a terrible situation where we were letting people run care homes for profit, and we forget about that. It was a completely private sector. A government could have said, you get the PPE, you get it now, you pay for it. They were making pretty big profits, the landlords who are renting out to them.
Thank you. Thank you, Harold. Thank you, Danny. Question from Graham here. Is there an example of a pandemic that's had a progressive social change?
Oh, okay. Pandemics, the famous one was the Black Death, but of course a lot of people had to die first. But then the price of labour went up across Europe. It's hard to know to what extent the 1918 pandemic may have contributed to progressive social change. The reason I mention that is that the last time we had peak inequality was around about 1913-1918, but it's hard to disaggregate the Russian Revolution from the First World War, from the pandemic and everything else that happened at that time. There's nothing to suggest that pandemics don't change how we think necessarily, although, to give you a sense of how much has changed, in the 1951 pandemic, there's almost no mention of it in the newspapers, except for a doctor telling people to stop fussing so much in the British Medical Journal. And in the middle of the 1957 flu pandemic, when as many people were dying as they're dying of COVID, and at almost exactly the point as many people were dying in 1957, the Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, told the population, "You have never had it so good." And they believed him, and the way he was right. So that shows the enormous change in attitudes. We would just let flu pandemics go through and accept that the elderly died. The change in attitude with this one is quite incredible, and it's partly international. If China hadn't locked down, if China hadn't got it under control, European countries might well have let it run through. And if other European countries hadn't locked down, I don't think this government would have locked down at all. We've seen a change in attitude to the importance of human beings, the importance of life at elderly ages. And I think that's absolutely fascinating, including criticising Swedes, which is quite like, I think you can be really optimistic when you get to the point where people are criticising social policy in Sweden. You go, because that's quite progressive. We want to a kind of real kind of battle for, moving forward. So the Swedes haven't done that badly. But if you're going to start saying we should do better than they do in Sweden on health, then start saying, well, what about the same in housing? What about the same in education? What about the same in unemployment?
Thank you. We've got a question here from Sylvia, and it is there anything in the data to suggest that COVID could be something that's trying to check the population as a sort of the planet protecting itself?
Yeah, is there anything on, in a way almost the opposite. So it's been a long time since 68. It's actually, we've been pretty lucky. So if there was any natural kind of population control or chance to get it, it's a sensible question. Are people endlessly saying, we do all the factory farming now, we do all these kind of things that increase our chances of pandemic disease? And they're sort of right, except the frequency of really deadly pandemics has actually reduced. So I'm not so sure. The other thing to say is we are now seeing the most dramatic slowdown in population numbers. Last year, 2019, fertility in Korea got to 0.99, less than one child per couple. That's a halving for the whole of Korea. The birth rate in this country dropped dramatically last year. 2019 is the biggest drop. Average age, I think it's 32 of having children. We're all waiting for the COVID birth figures, by the way, if you're geeky like me. The suspicion is they'll be really low. Could be completely wrong. You know, what else do people have to do when they're locked up? But the suspicion is that people would have avoided having children because they're so scared about the future. So that's good news.
Thank you. There's a question from Rupert here, and it's Danny, do you think we've got value for money from the huge financial deployment of packages during the pandemic?
Which packages? Yes.
Everything that the government has spent.
Oh, okay. No. But at least, Private Eye and whatever his name is, Johnny on the QC is... cock-up, unbelievable cock-up. So it, many of you would have seen the stories of how tenders have gone out without anybody competing, and how the friends of ministers have been given large amounts of money, and how I live in Oxford, and we used to watch the planes. The only planes in Britain flying were flying over us to Bryce Norton, carrying yet more PPE that didn't work from Turkey. It's sad, and the problem is we privatised NHS procurement a few years ago. So the NHS doesn't do its own procurement, it's done by profit-seeking companies that absolutely failed to do it. The contrast, just to give you another Nordic country, is Finland. In Finland, they've been stockpiling PPE and replacing it since 1957, since that flu pandemic, ready for the next one. So we haven't got value for money. On the other hand, we're not that different from France and Spain in our numbers, or Belgium. I think a more competent government could have saved 10,000 deaths in the care sector, but that would be most of the difference that they could have done, and they may have failed to have done that. The Swedish authorities failed to do that. They did pretty well otherwise, but Sweden has large care homes and they didn't keep it out of the care homes. So I'm not going to completely down the government on this. And the really good news is, at least when it comes to COVID and our behaviour of COVID and public health, we're not at all like a state in the United States. We're much more like a European country. The only exception is London, where the highest rate in Europe was deaths in Brent, which was 1 in 1,000 people dying in Brent, and the highest worldwide was in the Bronx, which was just over 1 in 1,000. But that wasn't government's fault. It's a dense city where it comes early too. Where government can make a huge difference is what they do now, when they've got more time, when the excuse of not having time or not knowing has gone. And this is when they've got to do better. And the government also mucked things up in the past. So they created Public Health England in 2012. Public Health England was always a mess. But it was a mess that was created by the coalition, supported by the current government, and was not fit for purpose. And it was their mess. And they've created the next one. Sorry.
Thank you, Rupert. Great question. We've got a question from Matt, and then I think we've got one more. Yeah. And then I think we're going to have to wrap it up. But Matilda and Dan are here with Danny's books, and they'll be selling them in the shop offers. And Danny is on at 1:15 doing Slowdown, which will be in that tent over there. So the question from Matt is, do you think there's going to be a huge rise in commercial rents as people are forced back into the office but at social distance?
I don't think people are going to be forced back into the office. That's just my feeling. Some will be forced back, but trying to get people back, say, to the towers in Canary Wharf, with any limitations of how many people go to a lift, is very difficult. As long as a firm is making enough money with its workers based at home, it's going to be less worried about forcing them back. And this model of working at home can work for some people. You can do more in 4 hours than you would do in the office in 7, because you're not chatting and doing other things. So I don't see that happening. I do see people giving up the rents in cities that they have because they don't need them. I do see them moving back with middle class parents, and that increase in multi-generational families, which then of course increases the risk from the pandemic. So one reason why Brent had the highest mortality rate is that Brent had one of the highest proportions of grandchildren living with their grandparents going on. But no, I see the housing market getting cheaper. The problem is that I know that Rishi wants the opposite. And because Conservative voters stop voting Conservative when their houses go down in value. So I think the Chancellor will do whatever he can to keep housing expensive in Britain. Whereas, not just a pandemic, but the massive out-migration we've had. People have left who could leave in the last 6 months, partly also because of Brexit. People haven't come in. There aren't jobs for people to come into. We are high immigration country because there are normally jobs for immigrants to do. Those jobs don't exist. People aren't going to come. The population is falling. And how you hold house prices up when the population is falling and people are squeezing themselves in with mum and dad and you've got more and more empty houses and you have some landlords starting a fire sale and desperately trying to sell because they can't get tenants and the Airbnb market's fallen apart. You can see where I'm going on this. House prices and rents should fall, but you've got a Chancellor and a government who desperately don't want them to fall.
Thanks, Ali. So final question now from Miranda. And the question is, have you looked at the data for black ethnic minorities in relation to COVID? And if so, have you shared the data with Imperial? And also your perspective on vitamin D deficiency or socioeconomic factors with this group and that data?
I'm glad you ended on that one, because I can honestly say I have. So I did a couple of weeks' work on that, largely secretively. There was a day when four reports came out, an incredible day, when four pretty good reports came out, saying you're twice as likely to die of this if you're black than white. And partly there's a group called Scientists for Labour, who give scientific advice to the Labour Party. And that group looked at it. So the short answer, because I know you don't want to go on and on about this, is there are people who study vitamin D who do think it's really important for this, but the consensus I saw said that vitamin D is not that important. Part of the evidence for that is pretty low rates of COVID in Jamaica and other places that go on. The key thing is that the reason that you're twice as likely to die of COVID-19 if you're not white is almost entirely structural racism. And the simplest way to explain this is that if you look at people aged over 75, half of people aged over 75 who are not white in Britain live in a tenth of areas in cities with the highest rates of COVID travelling through them. Whereas people who are white over 75 are much more likely to live in places like this out here, where the rate of COVID was low and it came less. Now, why do people over 75 who are not white live in the middle of our densest cities much more? It's because it's a place you can feel happier living in. It's almost for a very similar reason why older gay men are much more likely to live in cities, because you're accepted. So the evidence on it, the geographical concentration, all suggests that the rate is higher for younger people because you've got more jobs, which means that you're nearer and likely to get it. But most importantly of all, because this is a disease of the very elderly, because such a high proportion of elderly people who are not white in this country live in very dense areas, also sometimes with their grandchildren, and are much more likely to catch it for that reason. In countries without those kind of differences, where you have people who are not white living in the rural areas, you do not see this difference. So it's not an inherent greater risk. The only really key factor above all else is age. And then after age, having an underlying health condition has an effect. But usually that effect is not the same, not as bad, as just being 5 years older. If you want to remember one thing, it's age. Age above everything else. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Danny Dorling. It really...